Okay, thanks a lot. I plan this talk in a way that this is the first talk on gene expression on microarrays, so I review quite a few things. Okay, so since this is the outline of my talk, I will start by briefly reviewing gene expression and DNA chips, and then discuss clustering. This discussion of clustering, I'll briefly scan some of the methods that are used in the literature, because I'm sure that when you'll hear talks about this in the coming weeks, you will see quite a lot of results from clustering, and so you'll know what the various methods really do. The main part of the talk will be hopefully this, which is a method that we introduced to look at gene expression data. And the data I will be discussing comes from colon cancer, leukemia, and I'll show one transparency about glioblastoma. The same method has been applied on other problems, on document classification and on short-range stained glasses, and I'll not talk about those. Okay, so these are the aims of the analysis of gene expression data. One aim is to identify genes or groups of genes that participate in various biological processes. This hopefully will lead to diagnostic and even more hopefully to therapeutic tools. And another aim of this type of research is to find clues for the function of genes. As people mentioned, the genome is more or less known to some extent, and that is, we know the sequences, but we do not know the function of most of the proteins, and therefore identifying or providing clues for the function of genes for which the function is not known is also an important aim of this type of research. So since, as I said, I will be reviewing quite a few things, and by the time I get to the stuff that is probably of more interest, you'll probably be wiped out. Let me start with the end. So this is essentially one of them. This is the penultimate transparency of this talk, which I'll show now. So while you are awake, you see what are the main results of this analysis. What you see here, and during the talk, I will go through explaining just about everything, so you will know what everything means on this transparency. What you see in front of you here, this colored rectangle, is the summary of experiments done on 72 tissues taken from 72 different patients, each having leukemia. And there are 1,700 genes that one looks at. So this table, this colored blob represents a 1,700 by 72 matrix of numbers. And the numbers are color-coded. And what you see here, that there is a small rectangle, which we denoted by A, which has information about a few tens of genes, about 20 or 30 genes out of the 1,700. And this information about these small group of genes is used to analyze a subset of the patients, 40-some of them. So when you throw all the data away and keep only what's in this little box, then some new information emerges. Then you discover that this group of patients breaks into two very clear subclasses. Okay? One corresponds to a particular subclass of this type of leukemia, and the other group of patients to another subclass of this particular kind of leukemia. And you see this partition only when you use only these genes over only these patients. Okay? Moreover, we know who these genes are, and out of the 25 or 30 genes, four or five have known function. They have to do with T cells. And that gives a clue about the difference between these two sets of patients. One of them have some problem with their T cells, and the other ones have problem with their B cells. Moreover, knowing the function of four or five out of these 20-some genes, we have a clue for the function of the remaining 25, that for which we do not know the function at this point. So this particular example demonstrates the aims that I've outlined, and this is the end result of the analysis that I'll be telling you about.
We'll obviously go into this in more detail, but the partition of two subclasses requires the time history of the expression of the gene.
No, this is just the data in front of you. Okay? So the questions that you should be asking: how did I know which genes to pick in order to look at those patients, and how did I know which patients to pick in order to see this partition? And this will be...
So the partition, when you talk about the two groups, you mean that they have different disease states or whatever that...
No, I mean I see two groups. And you'll see eventually what I mean by that. Okay, just hang on.
But what you could do is you could differentiate the two groups prior to doing the gene analysis, or is it something that comes out only from the gene analysis?
Okay, this came out only from the gene analysis. The doctors who did the experiment, they actually knew that there are these two kinds of diseases, and they knew quite a lot. And but this was, what I told you, is the result of an honest, unsupervised analysis. We did not input any of this knowledge into the analysis, if that's what you ask.
The B,
forget B, I didn't mention B. You just look at, okay, patients go from here to here, so there are 72, so you look only at whatever is inside, that is, you look only at the first 40-some patients.
So there are yellow patients.
In a sense, yes, but they didn't come colored that way. They just recolored them. Okay, so I hope I got you interested. Okay, so how is this done? So this is the very brief review of gene expression. What you see here is a caricature of a cell. In the nucleus, you have DNA, and when a gene is expressed, the protein that is coded by that gene is produced. It's produced here at the ribosome, so the information has to be transferred from here to there. And that transfer is done by messenger RNA, as we heard. This is the process of transcription, and the messenger RNA is sent to the ribosome and gets translated into a protein. And of course, this is a very complicated process, which we have been hearing about for weeks, and I summarized it here in 2 minutes. So the point to remember is that when a particular gene is expressed, the cytoplasm contains copies of the corresponding messenger RNA. Okay? And another thing to remember, which is obvious, is that each and every one of your cells contains each and every one of your genes. So if the human genome has, let's say, 50,000, 40,000 genes, that means that each of one of your cells is capable of producing, if needed, 50,000 different proteins. But it's not doing that. And you have to be thankful for that, because you would be eating incessantly and dying incessantly if you did that. So every cell produces only that particular repertoire of proteins that are needed for its function. And of course, your retina needs a different set of proteins than a cell in your liver. This is the basic paradigm that we are using in this type of research. That if you want to know the state of a cell and the ongoing biological processes in it, it suffices to know the level of expression of each and every one of the genes. Now, this is sort of taken for granted, and one should think about it. I'm not sure this is a correct statement. I know some immunologists who object to this. But in principle, if you have 50,000 genes and you take a cell and someone gives you 50,000 numbers, the level of the expression of each and every one of these 50,000 genes, that should suffice to define the biological state of that cell.
But the level of expression is 0 or 1?
No, it's a continuous, it depends on the concentration of the messenger RNA and the efficacy of transferring.
That's on time average?
Well,
the cell cycle,
right. How shall I answer that? In a typical experiment, what they do in this kind of experiment, they extract tissue from a patient and they look at it. Okay, now you can do it at several times and see the progression of whatever process is going on. But you can just do it, take tissue from a tumor and look at it
at
a particular time. And
that's
right, but then you take that cell, there is an averaging process because the cells are not synchronized. So you take tissue, you usually don't take a single cell, but you take a whole bunch of them and you look at the what's there, and that the cell cycle is averaged over. Okay? Okay, that's a good question. So how do you measure the expression level of the gene? As we said, when it's expressed, the corresponding messenger RNA is produced. And the way we measure gene expression is by measuring, whoever does it, is by measuring the concentration of the messenger RNA. And that's a good point, because not all proteins are produced from the messenger RNA at the same rate and the same efficacy. But this is sort of what is measured, the concentration of the messenger RNA. And that is believed to reflect the level of expression of the particular gene. Yeah. I don't know. I really don't know. I wouldn't know how to trust this type of. To measure the concentration of the proteins is more difficult than measuring the messenger RNA. So. Okay, so the measurement of, so what we want to measure is the concentration of messenger RNA, and that is done by a DNA chip. So that's the tool which is used to measure the concentration of messenger RNA in the tissue. So this was the introduction of gene expression, and now I'll tell you about DNA chips also very briefly. This is a real photograph. This is what it looks like, and the size is, this is the actual chip, and the size is about 1 centimeter. And this is a blown up picture of it, and here is an even more blown up picture of it. This is an Affymetrix chip, and let me explain in a moment how I'll go into detail of these chips. On this type of chip, you have 12,000 pixels in quotation marks. When I say pixel, I mean a bit of the chip that corresponds to a particular gene or EST. And on each such gene pixel, you have up to 1 billion copies of that gene, and I'll explain what I mean by that. Sorry? I'll come to that, one moment. And this is sort of a quick outline. And when this chip comes into contact with material extracted from some tissue, which has mRNA, the mRNA diffuses around and sticks to its corresponding DNA. No, No, this is a very quick and dirty way. I mean, every statement here will be modified in the next transparencies. And if this mRNA is in some sense labeled by fluorescent labeling, then you wash off whatever didn't stick, you shine light on the thing, and you measure the amount of light that is coming out of every pixel, and that tells you how much mRNA is stuck there, and that tells you what was the concentration of mRNA in the tissue that you have poured on the chip. Okay, so this is a bird's eye view, and these are the two kinds of main kinds of chip. There are quite a few. This is an affymetrix chip, and this is a spot microarray. And the well, you'll no. I mean, some of them. This is a cheaper technology. Cheap, cost less. People make their own. Okay, the error bar on these numbers is usually a factor of 2. So if you take a... About, I would say, Gadi, do you know the... I mean, the problem... For the other. But the problems are usually in the low end, in the low concentration, and that's where it's problematic. So, okay, so what I'll do, I'll briefly describe this chip and even more briefly that one, okay?
Don't they, isn't there some sort of neutral, don't they mix two different colors together?
You will see, okay. So this is the first one, the spotted microarray. So what they do here is the following. They take, you have to remember, the implant, okay. They take a solution of single-strand DNA from one gene, and they deposit it on one spot of this array. So each of these spots contains many, many copies of that single-strand DNA taken from a particular gene. And now what they do, and this is the answer to your question, they usually test, compare two conditions. And they extract the messenger RNA from condition A and from condition B. And they want to compare the gene expression that you see in cells under these two conditions.
So in the example, like one of them might be a
tumor, normal. Tumor cell, normal cell. Okay, I mean, I mean, they are attached.
Yeah, but they are not sort of lined.
No, they are sticking, well, hopefully sticking up. So hopefully in a way which allows the diffusing, whatever you'll see what's diffusing, to stick to them.
So
they're not glued, they just put them down and I think. It's like. Okay, so I apologize. I mean, the chemical details I'm not familiar with. And you will probably have someone explaining it. How they make these chips. Okay. So in any case, the point is the following. So you deposit on this. So this chip contains a whole zoo of genes that you are interested in, that you decided that they may be relevant to test the difference between conditions A and B. And now you take the cells from these two conditions or experiments A and B, you extract the messenger RNA from both, and use the messenger RNA to prepare cDNA, the complementary DNA by reverse transcription. And this cDNA is labeled by a red marker for one condition and by a green marker for the second condition. Now you mix the two bottles of cDNA, pour them on the chip. This cDNA will diffuse, stick to where they find the matching DNA. You wash off whatever didn't stick. You shine red light, you shine green light, measure intensities, and you compare. And this gives you this. So each spot, as you see here, will have an intensity, a red intensity and a green intensity. So these spots here are red, these are green, and there are some there that have both. So in principle, you can measure the intensity of the absorbed, of the emitted light, which reflects the intensity of the absorbed cDNA from the two conditions. And this gives you a ratio of the two expression levels. Is this clear? You know exactly which spot is.
Yes, but I'm saying that you don't cluster a priori cluster spots
I don't think so. I think you lay down your genes in some order, whether they put genes that belong to one particular family together or not is. Okay, so these are these spotted arrays, and this is the Affymetrix chip. That's right. That contributes to the error in the experiment. Yeah. I mean they. Okay. So this is non-specific hybridization. Okay. And which exists and so Affymetrix tried to fight that in the following way. What they do. Each gene pixel in an Affymetrix chip is actually made of two rows, as you can see here, of 20 pixels in each. Okay? So let's talk about the upper row. The upper row has 20 little squares, and on each square you deposit a large number, let's say up to a billion copies, of a particular 25-mer, a string of DNA, which is 25 base pairs long, and you make many copies of that, and you stick those onto one little square.
What's the size of the square?
Well, you calculated, David. This is 1 centimeter, and they have 12,000 genes, and so okay, you're fast. So the upper row represents. They are taken from the same gene, from different points along the same gene, and they are carefully selected. And this is their secret: how they select them, because the way they select them, they want them to be as specific as possible to this particular gene. Since they are worried about this, the effect that you mentioned of wrong hybridization, they want to be specific, as specific as they can. So they select the 25 mers rather carefully. So that's one criterion of selecting them. What's the second row? The second row, they take the same 25 mers. And they mess up the central base on it. Okay? So they replace it by a wrong base. That's right. And there, the idea then is the following. If you worry about random hybridization, the probability that you will get something sticking to the one that you messed up is the same for whatever is swimming around. Whereas the probability for sticking to the right one is specific. And therefore, by looking at the ratio of the two intensities, or the difference, sorry, of the two intensities, you have a measure of the specific hybridization versus the non-specific one. And this is done for every pair of little squares, so you get 20 numbers which measure the extent to which you had specific response to this particular gene. That's correct. So they take averages. They throw out the highest, the lowest, and they take averages. And so it's a whole processing that goes into that. That's right. That's right. Yeah, and noise and so on. That's right. They have 25 males, and the other they have much longer strings. So there is some averaging going on there as well.
But the asymmetric chips that are available commercially must be dominated by the genes that are appropriate for medical technology. You couldn't just order one off the shelf if you wanted to.
You could, but it will cost you an arm and a leg. I mean, these chips, I think, cost now about a few thousand dollars. If you want them to prepare your chip for you, that costs a lot. By the way, the way these things are prepared is also a fun story. It's a lithographic technique. Okay, so since no one asked, I will not go into that.
Is there one available for pre-order?
Well, right now they talk about having the entire human genome on 5 chips. Okay? Okay, so this ends my story about chips. Okay, and this is these are the results of a typical experiment. This is an experiment on colon cancer that we return to. Here you have 2,000 genes whose expression level was measured for 62 patients or tissues. So this experiment cost about $1 million. And what they had, 40 tissues were taken from tumor, 22 were taken from normal tissue. And these are the 2,000 most vocal genes that were selected. And what you have here is a 2,000 by 62 matrix of expression levels. Well, these are the ones that whose overall expression level was the higher, over patients.
What is the correlation between experimental?
Okay. Okay, you don't correlate. No one has done that because this is $1 million experiment. So just to answer your question, to spend $1 million. But what people do, two different copies of the same chip, and they repeat the experiment, and they plot the new versus old results, and then that's what they compare, typically. Okay? And that's where they get this business of the reproducibility is about a factor of 2. Okay, this was done, I'll have the names later. This was done by, the paper is by Alon et al. This is the group of Arnie Levine.
So how many chips are you?
Well, here, actually, okay. At that time, the Affymetrix chips were smaller. So for each experiment, they used 4 chips. So altogether, they used 62 times 4 chips for these measurements. So you can calculate the cost. So what I'm trying to impress you with is that you have a huge amount of data. 2,000 by 60 is 120,000 numbers, and you have to extract some meaning from this massive arrays of data. And that's what we are trying to do, and this is the next part of my my lecture. So how do you analyze such data? There are two ways, two basic ways of analyzing such data. One is supervised and the other one is unsupervised. Now, supervised analysis is hypothesis testing. And you all know what is meant by that. You use all kinds of information that is available, clinical information or genetic knowledge, and you make an assumption that this difference that you are aware of manifests itself in the gene expression. And you take this hypothesis and test it. You use whatever statistical tests you are fond of. And this is a very powerful method, and it's controlled. People have been doing this for years, for hundreds of years. And it worked quite well. It has one serious disadvantage, that you will never discover something that you did not suspect. Okay? In hypothesis testing, this is all you do. You make a hypothesis and you test it, and you get an answer, yes or no. Is it different or not? If you want to uncover something hidden in the data that you did not suspect, this will not let you do that. And that's where unsupervised methods come in. These unsupervised techniques are more exploratory type of analysis, where you say, I do not use any prior knowledge, and I let the data speak. That is, I look for correlations and similarities that are in the data. And these are the methods that we are using. This is the family of methods that I'll be telling you about. So what are the goals of this analysis? To find groups of genes that have correlation expression profiles. That is, if these two genes are correlated, if one is high in patient 17, then the other gene is also high in patient 17, and vice versa, and some other patients, they go down. And one believes that if genes are correlated, then they may belong to the same biological process. They may share a promoter region, that they may be activated by the same transcription factor. So this is what you hunt for. Another goal is to divide the tissues to groups that have similar expression profiles. And then the assumption is that such tissues that have similar expression profiles or correlated expression profiles, there is somehow the same biological or clinical state. This type of analysis is done by clustering, so I'll tell you about clustering. Okay, so let me define the clustering problem. And I apologize for inflicting on you this type of... No. You, every other question you ask is about time. Time will not come into this analysis here. I mean, there is one expert...
So what does a profile mean?
Profile means... No, the profile means...
How hard is that to cluster?
No. By profile, I mean... Okay, David. The profile, I mean the following. If you take a particular tissue or patient, it's represented by 2,000 numbers. That's what I call a profile, gene expression profile.
I see. So you have a vector in multi-dimensional.
Precisely. Yeah. Okay. So I should have said that, and I did not, and that was a mistake. So let me go back. Let me backtrack for a moment. Okay. Since I didn't say that, you'll have to bear with me. I'll just run back to here. In this array of numbers, every column represents a particular patient. So each patient is represented by 2,000 numbers. So every patient is a vector or a point in 2,000 dimensional space. I'll be clustering those, as well as, if you look at the other way around, every row represents a gene. Each gene is represented by 62 numbers. The value of the expression of that gene in these 62 patients. And I'll be clustering those two. So these are 2,000 points in 62-dimensional space, or, if you wish, 62 points in 2000 dimensional space. Yes. Well, they maybe can be correlated.
No, not correlated. I mean,
identical.
Like
you mean the finger, genetic fingerprint? Well, I think that's right. I mean, yeah. That's the correct question. Even
<laughs> 62
tissues. Okay, I mean, do you want to get into that? This is colon cancer. So to get to those tissues is a surgical intervention of an unpleasant kind. So when you have a tumor, someone who has cancer, then okay, I mean, he has cancer, so you go there and get tissue out. Now, I don't think that a healthy person who will be, you know, approached and say, please, let's get some colon tissue from you for our experiment, you will appreciate that. So actually what they did, they took people who had cancer and took 42 tissue samples from the tumor and 20 samples from healthy tissue, but these were from the same 42 patients. Is this answer clear, or should I go into the?
It
of course does. Okay, so I'm careful. I'm saying it's 62 tissues, 40 some are.
But some same tissue.
Not same tissue, same patient. You go. This is a procedure where you go in and you extract tissue. So you hit the tumor and you extract tissue from the tumor, and while you are there, you go somewhere else in the colon and you extract tissue which is not from tumor, and that's healthy tissue.
Is it the same thing, say, with skin cancer, where it's easier to solve the problem?
Well, I'm not sure how they did it in that experiment. I mean, there are experiments on melanomas, but I'm not sure. There it's easier to get skin samples from someone, I guess. No. You did not torture the same patient 62 times. No. There are 42 people and you tortured once. Sorry? 42 patients were. 42 patients. And again, 42 patients. And from each of these patients had colon cancer. From each and every one of them, they extracted tumor tissue. So you have 42 different tumor tissues. From 20 of them, they also extracted from elsewhere healthy tissue, non-tumor tissue. No, it's not so grouped. It's randomly grouped. Everything is totally random. My analysis will do wonders.
But we already know those positions anyway.
I'm sorry?
We already know what those experiments are.
They know. They know, but we are not using that knowledge in our analysis. That's right. I use, after I'm done, I check, I look at their knowledge and try to, I'll explain that. Okay?
Back to the giraffe.
So, why do I use these funny animals for defining the clustering problem? Because it's an inherently ill-posed problem. It's an ill-posed problem.
Ill-posed.
So this is what, I mean, imagine the following experiment, and I use usually in a non-physicist audiences, so you'll have to bear with me. To define the problem, you take a child who has never seen a giraffe or a zebra, and show him lots of pictures of these animals and let him look at them without saying a word. This is an unsupervised method. And I've never done the experiment because my kids were grown up by the time I got into this, but I don't have any doubt that if you do this experiment, After enough time, this child will be aware of the fact that there are two kinds of animals that he has been exposed to. He will not know that these are giraffes and these are zebras. But he will know that these are two different kinds of animals. And what he has performed is clustering. So how does he do that? Well, when he sees an animal, he takes a large number of measurements. I don't know how many. Let's say 20 different measurements. Number of legs, length of tail, and so on. But there are two measurements that I'm sure he's making. One is measuring the length of the neck, and the other one is the shape of the coloration. By that I mean take the stripe and take the width divided by the length. And these two things are measured with beyond any doubt when you look at these kinds of animals. And every animal that the child sees is represented by, let's say, 20 different numbers. And I will project those points in a 20-dimensional space onto a 2-dimensional manifold, which is just these two parameters. So this is what you get. Every dot is an animal, and this is another group of dots, and you can guess who is who. Yeah. I gave this talk last week at Santa Cruz, and it's always the Cornell graduate who points this out. Okay, so this is one group of animals, and these are clearly zebras. This is another group. And if you have a Cornell PhD, then you immediately notice that this group actually breaks into two subgroups. So if someone asks you how many clusters are there, this is not a well-posed problem. The answer depends on the resolution with which you are viewing the data. Okay? Using the lowest resolution, when the child first sees this picture, he says animals. And then as you improve your resolution, you notice that there are two groups, and then you notice that this group breaks into two subgroups. And if you were forced to look at these pictures for long enough, you will pick up individual differences between each zebra and another zebra. And at that point, you will cluster the data such that every data point is his own cluster. Because by now you recognize every single individual. So the result of clustering analysis comes in the form of a dendrogram. And there is a parameter which controls the resolution, which I'll call T, such that with the lowest resolution, all data are in one cluster, and as you improve your resolution, it starts to split up into zebras and giraffes, and then it splits into old and young giraffes, because you see the neck length probably reflect the age. And then at a high resolution, at the highest possible resolution, each data point is his own cluster. Sorry?
It doesn't have to have a form of a tree. Because there are baby giraffes that kind of look like the island.
You mean it can have loops? Loops that we may close? Not in the method and the methods that we use. And you will see that it doesn't, you know, once they split, or once you join things, they stay together. And this is most of the algorithms work this way. And okay.
But if you try to cluster people in this room, you can cluster according to whether it's dark hair or long hair, or you can cluster whether we're going to ask it or whatever.
Definitely. Okay, it's not a unique. And the question that you ask is how do I know what weight to give to different features? And that's a very hard problem. But once you decided on giving weight, different weights to different features, you generate by these, by the methods that I'm going to talk about, you generate a tree. Yeah.
I think that, for instance, in Viva's graphs, I'm old and young, I'm sort of finished with this as well, but imagine you have various varieties of graphs. In that case, a dendrogram is the natural representation because you have things related in a dendritic path because of the evolutionary process. It seems, though, that if you're looking at clusters and such, that the dendritic pattern is not the natural way of doing this, that you would see a cluster, and that in your example of the child picking up patterns, they'll recognize, cluster here, cluster there, rather than that these are members of a set that can be defined as a set, rather than I'll link these two together, I'll link these together, I'll link these together, as you can do with it.
Okay, let me not answer that. I mean, let me go through various methods and then we can come back to this question and see whether I understood your question or not.
Okay. When you think of terms of set-theory, though, there is an issue of overlapping.
Of course, yes, there is. There is an issue of that, but as I said, okay, let me go two more times. But what you should take away from this very brief introduction is not giraffes and zebras, but a dendrogram, because you will see dendrograms right and left in this talk and in the talks that are ahead. So what you should remember is that this type of analysis yields a dendrogram. You go from everything is in one cluster and then it splits, and then this one can split again, until finally you get individuals. This is the result of the clustering analysis.
If there are really no clusters, how will the method...
It's a good question. That depends on the method. Good methods will tell you that the data are taken from a single cloud. And many other methods will not tell you that. Okay, this is one of the questions that you have to ask, whether the method is powerful or not.
So your method can figure it?
Of course.
I shouldn't have.
Okay, so again, just to drive it home, this is the method, what you expect, and these are the features that you should take note of. When someone produces a dendrogram, that imposes a linear ordering of the data, a one-dimensional ordering. It's not an obvious statement, if you think about it. Okay, I can define a way in which it is fairly unique, and let me do that. And, okay, here is the first splitting. So you place this to the left and this to the right. This is arbitrary, but... Now, these guys split. So there are two groups here. And you ask which one is closer to this one, and you place that closer. Which one is further away, you place that further away. And again, this is not unique, because how do you define the distance between groups? But in principle, once you take such a definition, a dendrogram imposes a linear ordering of the data. So when I produce a dendrogram of genes, that means that I give you also a way of linearly ordering those genes. This is what you should remember. Linear ordering imposed by the dendrogram.
So both dimensions have meaning.
Yeah, in a sense. I mean, this is resolution. This is sort of projecting this whatever n-dimensional, d-dimensional data onto a one dimension, which is less meaningful, but the dendrogram imposes that. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I mean, you can have situations where the clustering will be ambiguous. But when there is reasonably clear clustering, it imposes, you can generate from it a one-dimensional ordering of the data in the sense that things that are closer to each other along this one dimension are in some sense also closer in that n-dimensional space. Yeah. Yeah. In some, yeah. Well, in 1D, proximity is meaningful.
Yeah,
If they are very close to one another, that means that they are also close in that large dimensional space. Large distances are less meaningful. Okay. So, okay, there is another feature which is important. So this is one thing about the dendrogram. The other feature that is important to take note of is that if you want a good clustering method, should give you some handle on how significant or stable your clusters are. This is your question, essentially. A cluster is born at some resolution and dies at some other resolution. Dies means it disintegrates. And the range of resolution controlling parameter over which the cluster lives is a measure of its stability, of its statistical significance. Okay? This is when you have this is something I would require from a good clustering technique. So this is a more mathematical. Sorry?
Is that something that you can go over the connection?
I will not. I will not. This is a technical point which I will, if you want, we can discuss later.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What about structural stability of the cluster? Because suppose I add another attribute and you want to ask how sensitive is one cluster to the digital data? Is that something that...
Yeah, some methods are... Okay, there are quite all kinds of questions of that sort, of the stability of the outcome, of the dendrogram, against all kinds of noise, or against all kinds of changing the data. Yeah, you add some more parameters and so on. Okay, and that's something that, there is no universal question to answer to these questions. You have to check it for the algorithm that you use.
But in the huge dimensional space, the robustness of the clustering is important.
It is important.
It is important as it is. Saying this, the clustering is significant.
Right. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay, so this is a more, quote, mathematical statement of the problem. You have n data points embedded in some d-dimensional space. And what you want is to partition the data into m clusters, where you want points that belong to the same cluster to be in some sense more similar to one another. A good method is one where m is determined by the method, or it gives you a dendrogram. You don't want to impose m from externally, the number of clusters. And you want to be able to identify significant or stable clusters. And now I explain why I said that this is ill-posed. First of all, I didn't define what is more similar. And from the questions that I was asked, you understand that this is not that clear. Terry's question and some other questions. What I will consider as an important attribute for similarity may be considered unimportant by someone else. Okay? Someone asked me last week about the giraffes and zebras. What about male and female? To me, that didn't look like the most striking difference between these animals. But someone... Yeah. That's right. And of course, some people have, we know that some people have placed emphasis on that aspect.
The bottom line in your analysis, the doctor is probably going to be making you think they're used to being thought of as God.
Yeah, what's important and what's not. Okay, so these are the clustering methods that are applied to DNA data. And I listed a few of them. There are the agglomerative and hierarchical methods. And the other family of methods use centroids or representative point. I'll explain this later. And there are physically motivated methods. Deterministic annealing I will not discuss. This is a very nice method which was introduced by Rose, Gurevitz, and Fox. Rose, I think, is here at UC Santa Barbara. And this is the method that we will be using. It's called superferromagnetic clustering of data. And I'll explain this one, and this one. Okay, so what I propose is that we take a break and reconvene in about 10 minutes, and we continue then. Okay?